It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Karen Hartglass. Good afternoon on this Wednesday, March 9th, 2011. And you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. And we've got a really interesting program today. I'm looking forward to learning quite a bit. So what do we talk about on this show? We talk about food, because it's all about food. And frequently we talk about how food affects our environment, our personal health, the health of the planet, and certainly animals that are used in food production. And sometimes it all seems so simple, food, where it comes from. For those of us who remember, you take a seed, plant it in the ground, give it a little water, it grows, and then some wonderful things come out of that plant. Vegetables, tree may grow, fruit is can be taken from the tree, etc. But it's really gotten a lot more complicated than that, and we're going to be talking about a lot of that today with my guest, Phil Howard. Dr. Howard teaches undergraduate and graduate courses in community food and agriculture, as well as a graduate course in research methods as an assistant professor at Michigan State University. His research focuses on the food system. The food system involves all of the steps required to produce food and get it to our plates, from farming and processing to distribution and consumption. His work includes projects involving food consolidation, food environments, eco-labels, and he earned a PhD in rural sociology from the University of Missouri in 2002. And conducted postdoctoral research at the Center for Agroecology and Sustainable Food Systems at the University of California, Santa Cruz from 2002 until 2006. Dr. Howard, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. You've done some really fascinating work, and I'm looking at the msu.edu website where it lists a number of your research articles and really interesting subjects. And I think something that most of us are so in the dark about. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of your research. One of the things I've seen you working on is this consolidation of the food system. Specifically, there are these small companies that create organic food, for example, and then these bigger companies come along and gobble them up somehow. You've got a very interesting diagram of the different companies involved and who they were and what they became. What is all this work about?
Well, beginning in the late 90s, corporations started to evolve the... Do you hear an echo?
I don't. To you. Okay. You want to call us back? And or let's see. I'm talking to the engineer here. They have no echo, but you have an echo.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we have them call you back? Because we want you to be comfortable.
Okay.
Okay. So hang up, and we'll be right back with you.
Okay.
Great. Okay. Well, we've been having some interesting technical challenges today. And that's all that comes with the good stuff with internet and technology, which is amazing what we can do with it today. The fact that we can talk to so many people all over the place and have everybody join in with us. So, Dr. Howard, you're back with us?
Yeah.
Is it better?
That's a lot better.
Great. It sometimes is fun hearing your own voice, you know? Kind of knows you're there, but very distracting, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we were talking about corporations and gobbling up little companies.
Yeah, and this started to happen in the late 90s. The echo's back.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just fight through the echo here. In the late 1990s, the USDA signaled that it was a national standard, which would replace differing state and regional standards. And so this was going to make it a lot easier for companies to sell nationally and internationally. So you saw a lot of engineering organic companies begin to be acquired. And what was interesting is that very few of those acquisitions were made apparent on the products' labels. So this is a phenomenon that some people call stealth ownership. If you pick up a package on the store shelves, what you won't see is, for example, if you buy Cascadian Farm, you won't see the big G, the General Mills symbol.
Right. You get the feeling that it's still that small, friendly, concerned, mom-and-pop kind of company that creates a quality product.
Mm-hmm.
And that may or may not be true.
Yeah, in most cases, when you're buying processed organic food, it's not those pioneering independent companies anymore. About a third of the top 30 food processors in North America have acquired those organic companies.
Wow. Okay, so when we think about food that's organic, in a very simple sense, we think of when it's related to plant foods, it's plant foods that have been grown without pesticides and herbicides, not irradiated, not genetically modified, and not much more beyond that. And when it's organic animal products, I'm not as clear on that because I don't consume animal products personally, but I believe it has to do with the feed that the animals get.
Yeah, the feed has to be organic, and they're not allowed to use antibiotics or artificial growth hormones.
Right. And so what else is involved where the products change when they get purchased by a larger corporation?
Well, sometimes there's no change, but there are anecdotally some cases where some of those original ideals of organic have been lost. For example, when a dairy company, Dean, bought a company called White Wave Silk, which makes soy milk.
Yeah.
Originally, those soybeans were coming from the U.S., and then after they acquired White Wave Silk, they started buying soybeans from China and Brazil.
And what happens when they're from China and Brazil? Does that mean they have different requirements?
Well, it wasn't until about 2008 that the USDA started doing inspections of certifiers in China.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of concern that there might be some fraud going on with certification in China. But it also, you don't have the U.S. farmers being supported. Instead, you're sending the money overseas where the farmers are making a lot less money.
Right. So the big issues are, number one, products that we thought were organic and more healthful, and by local or at least U.S. companies are now bought up, and some of those materials that are put into the products may not meet the standards that we think they're supposed to meet, and they're also being grown in other countries where we don't know how the people who are doing the work and farming are being treated, and moving all that work overseas. So there are just so many different things that are involved with a simple soybean.
Yeah, and another thing that's happened to when some of these companies get acquired is they take a product that was organic and then they start selling it as a natural product, so it's not organic anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Odwalla did this with their juices. They used to have an Odwalla Organics line. Now less than 5% of what they sell is organic. 5% of their ingredients.
This doesn't sound very good. So is there anything good about this?
There are some good things. If those companies retain the commitment to organic, which, some of them do because there are price premiums, then the distribution becomes a lot broader. It's a lot easier to get organic food now in the United States than it was 10 years ago. You can get
right.
it at Walmart, at fast food restaurants, even vending
right.
machines. And in some cases, it's cheaper. When big corporations get involved, they're able to drive the prices down so the consumers pay less at the checkout.
Do you buy some of these products yourself?
Yeah, I try to buy organic foods. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I have... There are some companies that have made a conscious decision to remain independent, and I try to support those as much as possible if I'm buying processed organic foods.
And is there a way for us to know who they are other than being a PhD professor who does research in this area?
Well, there are a couple things you can do. One is to go to my website, and I have a chart of about 18 brands that have remained independent. Another thing you can do is go to a website called goodguide.com. And this was developed by a professor at UC Berkeley. They have ratings on about 22,000 food products right now. And if you have an iPhone, you can actually take a picture of a barcode in the store and pull up the product and see how it compares to other similar products.
Goodguide.com.
Mm-hmm.
And your website where this particular page is?
It has a tilde symbol, which sometimes is hard to find on the keyboard, but it's msu.edu/tilde Howard P, or you could just do a search on Phil Howard, Michigan State.
Right. Okay. Well, that's really good to know, and there's always something. It's kind of scary. Okay. So let's talk about some other things. What are eco labels?
These are voluntary identifiers on products that help consumer know what standards were involved in producing it. So organic is one very well-known eco-label, and it shows that that product embodies the things we were talking about, avoiding synthetic pesticides and fertilizers, and for animal products, the feed is organic, and they haven't been exposed to antibiotics. Another one that people are pretty familiar with is fair trade.
Right.
And this applies to products that are imported from other countries, and it means that the producers have a fair compensation for their product, particularly if they're cooperatives that are producing it, or if they're working on plantations and the workers are getting adequate wages and have the right to organize.
And these labels, is this a volunteer thing? Are there specific requirements in order to be able to give yourself a fair trade label on a product or an eco label?
Yeah, most of these eco labels involve third-party certifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So for organic, you can go to an organization like California Certified Organic Farmers, pay a fee, fill out some paperwork, and show that you're meeting the requirements, and then you can use that label on your product.
And are these certifications pretty reliable? Can we trust them?
Well, it depends on what it is. Some of these eco-labels are first-party or second-party where there's kind of a financial conflict of interest.
Oh, good.
So you have to be careful. Consumer Reports has a website about eco-labels, and you can look at this and see which ones are more trustworthy than others.
Okay. I'm definitely going to check that out. I know a lot of people talk about organic food, and I buy organic food, and I feel good about it in some ways. I try and buy as best I can locally grown produce, close to the farmer as possible. But the thing is, many people say that how do you know food is really organic? And, you know, they've heard a lot of things where it really isn't true and you're just paying a lot more money for something that doesn't really bring you any more benefit. Is there something to this, or can we be confident for the most part when foods are labeled organic?
Yeah, I think we can be pretty confident that most organic food is meeting the minimum standards set forth by the USDA. They've been pretty vigilant about checking certifiers in the United States and Latin America, more recently they started to check into things that are going on in China. So at least with domestic produce, you can be pretty confident that organic means what it says. Although on the other hand, it's become pretty difficult for small-scale farmers to meet the certification fees and the paperwork requirements. So some of them have made a decision to go outside of the organic certification system. And so they either tell their customers directly about their production practices and how they're either meeting or going beyond organic standards, or they might use something. There's a peer certification system called Certified Naturally Grown, which uses organic as kind of a base minimum standard, and then farmers who are participating can inspect each other's farms to make sure that they're actually following those practices.
Yeah, I've heard about this, and I'm glad you brought it up, and it brings up just so many different issues. But here you have the small farmers who are, for the most part, I want to believe, are creating quality products, want to do the best they can, and yet, thanks to government regulation, which indeed we need, it kind of pushes them out of the market because the red tape, the paperwork, is expensive and time-consuming and really not doable for these people.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay, so it's good that they've come up with this alternative. What was the name of that peer group again?
It's called Certified Naturally Grown.
Certified Naturally Grown. I imagine they must have a website, too.
Yeah.
Certified Naturally Grown. Definitely we'll check that out. So do you eat organic food?
Yeah. I mean, I try to grow as much of my own food as I can, but I'm a member of my local food cooperative, and most of what they sell is organic. So I try and buy unprocessed food as much as possible. But you know, there are times when it's a lot easier to pick up the processed foods, which tend to come from the bigger companies.
Well, I think what's really important, at least in my opinion, is really trying to seek out local community sources for the bulk of our food. We've gotten so detached from where our food comes from, how it's made, who grows it, who manufactures it, what goes in it. And I, there are kids today that don't know that apples grow on trees. You know, we're that detached from where our food comes from. And it's having a tremendous toll on our environment and on our health. And I don't know about anybody else, but I feel really good when I go to a farmer's market or a co-op and you talk to the people that are making the food. There's this just this great bond and this great feeling of community. And I think there's a certain amount of more than nutrition in the food. There's energy and other things that we can't really measure that give us much a higher quality nourishment, maybe some nourishment for the spirit as well when we get closer to our food.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for the community to actually be able to interact with the people that are producing your food.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're a lot more accountable when they know who's going to be on the other end eating that food.
While we're on the subject of community, I know you've done some research work about communities, minority communities that don't have access to quality food or aren't consuming quality food. What are some of the things that you've discovered about these disenfranchised communities and nourishment or nutrition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an area of research that's really taken off in the last 10 years, looking at retail food access. And in the United States, most studies, though not all, have found that low-income and minority neighborhoods tend to have less access to sources of affordable, nutritious produce like supermarkets. And they tend to have better access to foods that aren't as good for you, retailers like convenience stores and fast food restaurants. So I've been doing some work in California and then in Michigan, and we find that there's a pretty big difference depending on what form of transportation you use. If you have access to a car, here in Lansing, you can get to a supermarket within a 10-minute drive almost anywhere in town. But if you were on foot, there are very few people there within a 10-minute walk of many types of fresh produce.
Mm-hmm. Are there, you know, I live in New York City and I don't have a car, and it's by choice because we have good public transportation and we have great stores within walking distance. But are there a lot of people that don't own cars?
Yeah, depending on where you're at in the U.S., in urban areas, about 10 to 20% of people in a typical city won't have cars.
So, mm-hmm. Wow.
And that makes it really difficult to, pattern is that the supermarkets have closed down, their inner city stores have moved to the suburbs where it's a lot less expensive to build a new store, and they see higher profit margins.
So what can we do in these communities to get access to healthy food if the supermarkets don't want to be there?
Well, here in Michigan, there have been some state incentives for supermarkets to come back into those areas that they've left. But that's a pretty difficult battle to fight. So there's a group in Philadelphia called the Food Trust, and one of the things that they're doing is trying to encourage corner stores to offer more healthy foods. And they're trying to help them go together and buy in bulk so they can get much lower prices for the produce, because one of the problems they have is they can't compete with a supermarket that's buying from all over the world with the volumes that they buy.
So, I see.
You know, trying to get more fresh produce into these corner stores is one approach.
Well, the spaces, the businesses are there. It's just what they're stocking on their shelves that isn't really good. And so if they had the ability, either through some subsidy or help, to put healthy food on the shelves, would the people buy the food?
Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and egg problem because, over the years, some of the, those foods are very perishable. They're difficult to keep in stock without losing money. It's a lot easier to stock candy and soda, things that aren't going to go bad quickly. And over the years, those healthy foods have dropped off the shelves, and people have become accustomed to not having access to them or going very far out of their way to get those types of foods. So just simply dropping them back on the shelves, people may not be in the habit of buying those foods, may not even know how to prepare them.
Have you got involved in this sort of research with educating communities about healthier food?
Not a whole lot. There are groups here. There's an effort to bring fresh local produce into the convenience stores here in town and do that type of education, including going to farmers markets and helping people learn how to cook the things they find at the farmers market, which they may not have seen in their local stores.
It's so crazy because I think the solutions are so simple. When people eat simple, healthy food that's really easy to prepare, they end up being healthier, they have more energy, kids are shown to have better IQs, they do better in school, they do better in life, and it's like a cyclical thing where one thing enforces the other and it's all improvement. But when people aren't eating healthy food and they don't have access to it, it just makes it harder to rise above. Just takes a lot of energy from so many different sources to get us back to where we were at some point.
Yeah, definitely.
And I've seen a number of different documentaries where they interview people that are poor and don't have access to healthy food, and they just want something that's quick and cheap, and you've got this kind of crazy competition, or not even competition, but, McDonald's dollar meals. And, I know beans and rice, probably the cheapest food you can get, and I eat grains and beans every day. It's because it's healthy food. And so many people just have forgotten this. I mean, it's supported so many populations, so many civilizations over thousands of years, and yet we seem to have forgotten this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great success story in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, which is the fourth largest city in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it a goal to eliminate hunger in their city. So they committed 1% of the city budget, and they had a huge number of initiatives to try and make it easier for people to eat healthy food, including more farmers markets, posting prices of produce on bus stops so people know where to go in town to get the most inexpensive produce. And one of the things they've done is created these people's restaurants where they source food from the neighboring farms and they prepare meals that are very inexpensive. And although about 85% of the people who go there and buy these healthy and expensive meals are low income, people of all income levels go. You see men in business suits eating meals there, and it is, you know, a lot more convenient than trying to cook your own rice and beans.
Right. Oh, I like that story. I like happy stories. Do you have any more happy stories?
There are a few out there, yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, you can tell us a happy story or two, and I'd like to talk about some other subjects like seeds. And, well, we'll be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, 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 don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs. Cheater in the Rood. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And I am here with Dr. Philip Howard, and we're talking about food systems, where our food comes from, what goes into it, how it gets to our plate, and all the complications involved in between. Okay, Dr. Howard, I wanted to talk a little bit about seeds and something so simple. We can't live without seeds because our food comes from seeds. And there seems to be a lot of control going on with seed availability.
Mm-hmm.
You've been doing some work with consolidation of seed availability, something like that?
Yeah, I've been looking at changes in ownership in the seed industry at the global level. And what we've seen in the last few decades is some big multinational chemical and pharmaceutical companies have got involved in the seed industry. Whereas, you know, back in the 1970s, it was mostly just a mom-and-pop industry, a lot of very small companies. There were thousands of them all over the country. Now you have these big six chemical life science companies that have become pretty dominant in the global seed industry.
Well, they've obviously done that because they see some profit involved.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, seeds are a pretty profitable business, second probably only to pharmaceuticals. But even so, some of the prices they paid for these acquisitions, in some cases 3 times annual sales, were pretty high. And it's obviously based on the expectation that they're going to make even greater profits in the future.
Now, is it true that in order to get higher prices on seeds, the companies have to manipulate the seed in some way to make it their own in order to charge higher prices?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's driving this is a 1980 Supreme Court decision allowed patenting of life. So now you can patent a gene and therefore patent a seed and require that a farmer has to go back every year to buy that seed. They can't just save it and replant it like they could with seeds that weren't genetically engineered.
So this all goes under the subject of genetically modified organisms in food, because that's what they're doing.
To a large extent, although they're trying to extend the precedent they set with this to even apply it to seeds that aren't genetically engineered.
But seeds that are maybe hybridized, or what do we do to seeds if we don't genetically modify them?
Well, what they do is they try and use genetic technologies to try and identify what they're changing with conventional breeding and then say that they also own that change.
And are you comfortable with this trend?
No, not at all. I mean, as you said, seeds are the very foundation of life. So.
I'm totally freaked out, personally.
So it's a pretty significant change we're experiencing here, and, you know, it's another one of those things that a lot of people aren't aware of. It's pretty hidden from us.
So these companies are looking to control all the seeds, and they're doing a pretty good job of it because they're buying up all the other companies, and then they're manipulating the seeds. And so a number of things are happening. One is what's happening to the original, what do we call them, heirloom varieties, and will they even exist? And then the other thing that's happening is diversity is kind of going extinct because they're changing a few seeds and pushing all other varieties out.
Yeah, it's really difficult to fund research on heirloom varieties.
Mm-hmm.
Starting back in the 30s, really the first crop that's happened with was corn. To that point, universities have been very involved in improving heirloom varieties of corn. But with the development of hybridization, which was a biological way of keeping farmers from saving their seeds. If you save your seed, it doesn't grow like the original plant. So you have to go back to the company every year and buy their seeds. And that so a lot of resources started to be shifted into hybridization, and now more recently with genetic engineering. So the research is focused on a much smaller number of plants, the ones that are ultimately going to be owned by big corporations.
I remember reading stories about different, the hundreds of varieties of rice in Mexico and in other and further down in South America. And I'm sure it's true of corn and so many other plants that we have. And they're getting contaminated from the genetically modified varieties that are coming from the United States. So even those that have wanted to preserve different varieties are having a difficult time doing so.
Yeah, with corn in Mexico, it's become very difficult to maintain that diversity and not have them pick up those genetically engineered traits.
Do you have any suggestions on what we can do about this?
Politically, one of the things people are doing is trying to reverse the decision that allowed patenting of life. There are groups like Greenpeace, coalitions of groups that are saying we need to end patents on life.
Mm-hmm.
This is really taking things too far. They're taking seeds that have been developed over millennia by farmers and then making one that will change and saying, now we own this.
Right. I've read stories where they haven't even changed things and they discover something that indigenous people have been using for thousands of years and they say, well, it's ours because we found it.
Mm-hmm.
It gets really, really crazy when greed and profit are involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen... it just seems like the government continues to support genetically modified food. We've seen recent discussions about sugar beets and alfalfa, and it just seems like they just keep allowing more and more rather than listening to our concerns and getting a little more prudent about approvals.
Yeah, it's a little different situation than in Europe. They've approved some genetically engineered varieties of crops, but much less than here, so you don't see it on the same scale.
But I get nervous, too, because I thought Europe was sort of was going to be our rock, and yet they've let stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody kind of kowtows to these big corporations. It's really scary. So, are there things that we can do on an individual level? I do what I can where I support local farmers. I buy organic, which means it's not genetically modified unless it's been contaminated a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we collect our own seeds. I live in an apartment. I have a balcony, and I grow stuff there, but it's kind of silly. It's not a big farm. But I try and save seeds just to go through the process of it, because I just think it's something that we should be doing, everyone.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great thing to do, because even if it's on a very small scale, you're at least maintaining the knowledge of how to save seeds.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of farmers, they switch from saving their own seeds to buying from a company every year, and then eventually they lose that knowledge of how to save seeds. So, trying to cultivate heirloom varieties and trading with neighbors and maintaining the diversity of the varieties that are out there, seeking out things based on taste, not things are bred these days more for being very durable and looking nice and being able to be shipped very far, but not for taste. So there are groups like Slow Food that are working to preserve varieties that are really selected for their taste.
Okay. Well, it's good that there are little pockets of people, but we all need to be participating, and we need to participate with what we do with our dollars. To me, bottom line, that's the only way to make change. You either support a product or you don't, and change will happen when companies start seeing an impact to their bottom line. And it doesn't take much. It could be, 10 to 15% of a bottom line where they realize there's less interest in a product to make the product go away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what about companies that sell seeds? And I know that some of them, too, have been bought up, the good ones. I think of Seeds of Change. I know there are a number that sell organic seeds, and are they owned now by these larger corporations?
For the most part, if you're buying organic seeds, you're not supporting those big six life science companies. Seeds of Change is a kind of a neat case because they were acquired by M&M Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've been a little more involved on the with changes on the processed foods that they sell. But from, as I understand it, they haven't been made many changes to the seed business. There's one thing you have to be careful though. There was a company called Seminis, which was put together by a Mexican billionaire, and got to the point where it controlled about 20% of the global fruit and vegetable seed market, 40% of the U.S. market, and then it was acquired by Monsanto. And they carry some varieties that are popular with organic farmers, like early girl tomatoes. So some seed companies have gone out of their way to either drop those varieties or make it clear to their customers that this is coming from Monsanto.
Right. We don't want to help them any way that we can.
Mm-hmm.
Do they do anything that's good?
They claim to.
I know. Everything they claim to is good. Now, I know you've done some research with underserved communities, urban communities probably, but I'm not sure how involved or familiar you are with third world countries, for example. A lot of times, especially from Monsanto and other companies, they talk about how important genetically modified food is in order to feed the world, and they really want to play on the compassion of most people, because nobody, for the most part, wants people to starve. We want everyone to have enough food to eat. And so when we hear that there's a technology that can help feed people, we're swayed by it. And yet, from everything that I've read, those in the developed world that need help, genetically modified foods are not high on the list. And it's things like improvements in the way they grow food, access to water, improving soil quality and better distribution, and certainly politics plays a part. Do you think genetically modified food can help feed the world?
No, I mean, if you look at the research, there are very few examples of genetically engineered varieties that have increased yields compared to conventional varieties. So, you know, there's a lot of hype about increased yields and other traits like drought tolerance, but ultimately the crops that have been adopted by farmers have been adopted primarily because they're easier to manage. It's easier to plant a round of Freddy soybean and then just spray right over the top of your crop to manage weeds rather than trying to spray in between trees. In between crops, like you had to do with conventional varieties. So, there are a lot of claims and a lot of appeals to feeding the world, but you know, people like Michael Pollan and others have pointed out we're producing a lot more food than we can eat right now globally. The problem is getting it to the people who are hungry, feeding it instead to a lot of animals. We're seeing increased meat consumption all over the world from the affluent. Consumers, but the people who are hungry are just not able to access all the food that is being produced.
That's right, and I certainly know in this country we throw away a lot of food, big percentage. So there's a lot of food out there. We just don't get it to the right people.
Mm-hmm.
What about food scares when food gets contaminated? Are you involved in any of the studies with that?
Yeah, I've done a few studies of this. I've looked at the spinach contamination epidemic in 2006 with E. coli 0157H7, and then more recently the salmonella in eggs last year.
Yep.
In both those cases, it took an FDA recall for us to realize that in both instances there were over 40 different brands being packaged from one or two sources. So, our food system has become so consolidated. We go to the grocery store and we see 50,000 different items, and it looks like we have all this choice, but when you actually look at who owns or who's producing that food, it's a much, much smaller number, and it makes us very vulnerable when there is an outbreak. It's shipped all over the country and affects a lot of people.
diversity is so important in so many ways, not just in people and respecting our individual cultures and backgrounds and who we are, but also with everything, with our food. You know, we can go back to the potato famine where, you know, one type of potato was grown and it wiped out a food supply for so many people. We need variety in so many ways. And when there are food scares like this, where one supplier is supplying so many different products, it can be really, really scary. But the thing is, why did that spinach get contaminated, and why did those eggs get contaminated?
Well, in the case of the eggs, they suspect that the feed was contaminated, and so there were two producers in Wright County, Iowa, that that had the same source of feed.
And the feed got contaminated with what?
With salmonella. So that ended up in the eggs.
And the salmonella came from where?
I don't know.
Yeah, the reason why I'm going this way is because as a problem solver in my own training, you know, you always want to look for the source. Unfortunately, a lot of times with personal health, doctors are always trying to treat symptoms rather than treat the cause. And it's always so important to go back to the original source. So where did that salmonella come from? And, you know, I don't know in that particular case, but what I do know is with animal agriculture, specifically, these animals are crammed into very small places for the quantity of animals that are there, and they live in filth and excrement, and all of this stuff creates disease and contamination and E. coli and salmonella, and it's no surprise to me. It goes into the water system, it goes into the soil, it goes into everything. I'm surprised we don't hear about more contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I get very wrapped up in this. So just back to bigger stores or corner stores offering food where food currently isn't offered. Is this a good thing that Walmart and Target, other stores like that, are starting to have more space for produce?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's great for consumers to have access to more types of produce, more affordable produce, but it's not good for farmers. I mean, Walmart is an incredibly powerful actor in the food system, and they're very famous for driving down the prices they pay to their suppliers.
Mm.
If you're a farmer, you can sell a lot of product to Walmart, but chances are every year they're going to come to you and say, we want to pay you less and less and less. And
right. Do you know how the subsidies play into the food costs? I understand there's all different kinds of subsidies for dairy producers and cattle producers and for corn growers, and it definitely affects in strange ways the prices we pay for food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gets really complicated. I mean, I've got a PhD and I can't figure out But one thing it does is it really benefits the companies like ConAgra and Cargill that buy, subsidized commodities like corn and soybeans. So even though the farmers are getting some payments, ultimately most of the profits are being passed through to the big companies.
Mm-hmm.
And they benefit by having high profits, and it makes, you know, unhealthy foods artificially inexpensive. So if you go into a grocery store, the cheapest calories are going to be in the soda aisle or the snack food aisle, and it's really expensive on a per-calorie basis to buy fresh produce, the types of foods that aren't subsidized.
That has got to change. That has got to change, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to change, if Michelle Obama is going to have some influence there or what, but I remember was it the Sierra Club that put out the video, The True Cost of Food? Because we, even though on the shelves we might see a low price for something like soda or chips or something, the real cost behind them we pay in our tax dollars. We don't even see it. And so even though I try my best to buy healthy, organic food, I'm still paying taxes to support all this junk that I don't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a democracy. How did you get into this field?
I just happened to go to the University of Missouri, where there are a lot of professors who have been following this issue for a long time. One of the things they've been doing is looking at consolidation and commodities like corn and soybeans and meat processing. And they've been concerned about high levels of consolidation that are getting higher and higher. I mean, you probably heard that the beef processing industry is more consolidated than it was at the turn of the century when there was a meat trust that ended up being broken up by the federal government.
Mm.
So, you know, all the trends are really going in the wrong direction in terms of we're losing control of our food system. Big corporations are getting more and more powerful, but that's not inevitable. I mean, this is a system that was built by humans, and we have the power to change it.
So do you see some hope for us? Are there some things that are turning around?
Yeah, I think it's been really amazing to see the level of interest in food. People are starting to get concerned that they know so little about where it's coming from and how it's produced, and they're learning more about it. And you have best-selling books that are kind of unveiling what's really going on behind your food, and you have a lot of young people that want to get involved in food production. They want to start farming and selling the produce to their local communities. So all that's really positive, and I think given the rising oil prices and rising food prices, the food contamination epidemics, there are a lot of things that make our food system really unstable, and I think things are just going to have to change for the better pretty soon.
It has to change. So what's your vision for what our food system should look like?
I mean, I think just to reverse the direction things are going now, it's going towards this global consolidated system where we have absolutely no say in how our food produced. If we could just swing that, get that going in the other direction so that more of our food is being produced locally by people that we know, by people that respond to our concerns, all of that would be positive.
So you think maybe the government should have some sort of incentive programs to get people back to small farming and maybe take away some of the subsidies to the larger giant agribusinesses so that it's not so profitable for them and makes it more doable for smaller farmers?
Yeah, I mean, ending the subsidies for the big corporations, all those indirect ways that we're paying for their profits would be a great start. And there are countries in Europe that have also tried to subsidize and encourage more organic farming and local farming.
Yeah, you've mentioned projects in Brazil and in Europe. Is there anywhere in the world where they're doing it right?
One example people use a lot is Cuba. I mean, they were kind of forced to deal with the loss of their fossil fuel supply, so they made a transition to ecological farming pretty quickly, and it was pretty traumatic. I mean, most people in the country lost weight when they switched from a more traditional Western diet to a much more self-sufficient food supply. I haven't been there, but people who have say that there are a lot of positive examples to take away from that.
Huh, that's fascinating. But unfortunately, something has to happen that isn't so positive in order for us to get in a better direction, and I really don't want to see bad things happen, like people not having access to food and people going hungry, but I hope it's not inevitable.
So we
should be supporting these local farmers. We should, if we can, be growing our own food, saving our seeds. Are there particular foods, personally, I'm just curious about your own diet, what you eat and what you don't eat? from all the knowledge that you have about where our food comes from?
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons to eat kind of lower on the food chain, to eat less meat, to eat more grains, fruits and vegetables. You know, Mark Bittman talks about being a vegan 2 meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that can really shift our food system in a more positive direction to increase the demand for fruits and vegetables and kind of decrease the demand for really inexpensive meats that are coming from you know, confined animal feeding operations and things like that.
And you have a lot of exposure to young people, obviously, because you're teaching students. Do you see, are they open to this, open to eating more healthfully and buying food that's better for themselves and better for the environment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have a lot of readings in my undergraduate class, and the reputation is the class is going to turn you into a vegetarian, even though that's not my intent.
Mm-hmm.
I think just learning more about where your food comes from, students, it's very, very common for them to talk about changing their eating and purchasing habits.
Right. You know, it's too bad that people have that stigma about becoming vegetarian or not eating animal foods, but, you know, I have my personal desires where I would like this world to be. I would like no pain and suffering for any sentient beings. But certainly we could all do our best by eating more fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an easy, easy thing to do. Well, Dr. Philip Howard, thank you so much. Thank you for the work you've done and you continue to do. I think you're really helping make a difference.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you, and keep doing it.
All right.
And your website, again, I guess the easiest thing to do is go to msu.edu and search on your name, Philip Howard.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. Have a delicious week.